Hi, and welcome to The Missing Middle. I'm Kara Stern.
And I'm Mike Moffat.
And today, we're going to discuss economic forecasting models with Scott Cameron, who's an economist formerly with the Parliamentary Budget Officer in Ottawa and now working in government in the Channel Islands. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
The Bank of Canada is switching up its forecasting models, and that kind of gave us an opportunity to talk about economic modeling and forecasting kind of more generally. So I think the best place to start is, what are they trying to forecast with these models?
Well, to conduct monetary policy, you need a vision of where the economy is going to be. You can kind of think of it as, you know, the old hot water taps where you would turn on the hot water and it would be a couple of minutes before it would actually reach you. So you're trying to get just the right temperature while this delay, this lag is happening. So if you don't get that kind of projection just right, then you end up burning yourself. And the Bank of Canada is essentially trying not to burn itself. It needs to know where to set its policy interest rate to get the sweet spot of growth that we want to see without generating too much inflation or deflation.
I know we're talking about how the Bank of Canada is changing the way it measures the whole Canadian economy. But before we talk about the way it's changing, can you tell us a bit about, like, how do they currently capture and measure the Canadian economy?
Yeah, so they currently have a system of two models that they use for policy simulation and forecasting. If you are driving your car from, say, Toronto to Windsor, and you set the cruise control to 100 kilometers per hour, the best forecast of your speed in 5 minutes, in 10 minutes, is going to be 100 kilometers per hour. All we need to know is how fast the car is going and how fast it's been going. But if you're the cruise control system, which is the Bank of Canada, you need to know how the engine works. You need to know how the transmission works. You need to know how that car and the power unit and the fuel injection system all come together to power the car. But knowing how that all works is not going to tell you anything about how fast the driver's going. So you essentially need both of these tools if you're going to want to plan the economy where the Bank of Canada, we at least think, does. They're kind of pulling the strings behind the scenes to give us this steady 100 kilometers per hour. But neither of these systems is going to be able to do both. Well, that's what we thought. And now they think that they've released this blueprint that says they are moving to kind of a jack of all trades, holy grail mega model that's going to be able to both do the theory and have good forecasting performance.
Do you believe them?
I'm a mere mortal. So if they think they can do it, they probably have. But it is a really good occasion to discuss the history of macroeconomic modeling and the successes and failures and kind of why we think that these kind of models that they are moving to have been a problem in the past and where they may be going to fix those or address those. So the models that they had, you had Totem and Lens, they were called. And Totem stands for the Terms of Trade Econometric Model. That doesn't really matter. This class of models was a DSGE, Dynamic Stochastic General Equilibrium. We won't get into that. But it was a direct translation of textbook theory into the computer. But more than that, it was a mashup of microeconomics and macroeconomic theory. There was, in the past, these forecasting models, these kind of very messy, somewhat of a veneer of economic theory, but really practical data-driven models that were criticized. Mike, you can jump in here by the Lucas critique. A fellow came in and said that these don't really make sense from a theoretical perspective. Do you have any Any insight into that, Mike, from your teaching days?
Oh, well, my days at University of Rochester. yeah, well, the idea behind the Lucas critique is essentially that you've got these relationships between variables, but use if you don't understand the underlying relationships, you're going to basically get to bad forecasts. So, you know, I call this the, you know, people selling umbrellas causes it to rain kind of models. So yeah, you had these big econometric models in the 1970s, which were based on all of these historic relationships, which then stopped working, you know, when you had the oil price crisis and so on. So, and I think we can see a lot of this in recent years where, you know, our economic models, you know, back in 07 and 08, didn't do a great job of incorporating financial markets and financial frictions. In, you know, 2020, you know, pandemic era, there wasn't really much in there about supply chain disruptions, and a lot of the inflation in these models tended to be on the demand side. So, you know, there's only so much that these models can do. And Scott's right that, you know, there's basically two ways of doing things. One is to rely really heavily on theory. And the second is to, you know, just look at past relationships. And the models based on the past relationships work very, very well until they don't. And that's why it's helpful to have that theoretical backstop.
What I've learned is that you economists really like your car analogies, because I know that the former governor of the Bank of Canada, Stephen Poloz, made the analogy that bank forecasting is like driving a car that's probably going to move forward, but it could also suddenly veer left or right. And does that kind of feel right to you? Does that make sense to you, Scott?
There is a reason why a lot of macroeconomists are amateur mechanics. A lot of people felt they were going down the wrong road with this kind of representative agent DSTE modeling, it's called. And that's where the bank was, because they need to know it was sold as, and it's to some extent true, the only way you can make policy decisions. Because if we go back to our car analogy, a mechanic can pull apart the engine and see how it works. Economists cannot do that with the macroeconomy. You can only use introspection and the kind of fundamentals that you can derive from the way all of us behave individually. The model they're going to, this giant kind of jack of all trades model, is again this DSGE modeling, this very textbook theory representative agent modeling. And so that's a bit of an interesting choice given a lot of the criticism after the 2008 crisis.
How does it work, that one version, the one model? Are they taking the two and trying to blend them together?
They literally have this these theory DSGE models at the center of a universe. They've got a diagram in there where it is the black hole at the center of the universe, and they're complementing it with a number of satellite models that they'll use, but it's going to be the main core model. Some of the satellite ones will do a bit of this more reality-based forecasting, and there are some, you know, we don't want to attack a straw man here. They are complementing it with some other approaches that they will use as tests of the main model, but they are moving to this model, and it does feel a bit like the kind of the, should be a better word for it, but for lack of a better word of it, the cult of DSGE modeling.
Mike, what do you think about this?
I would add that this, you know, this issue of the sort of dual approaches and things like that, this is actually not particularly unique to economics. So you actually see this a lot in meteorology. Like if you wanted to predict the percentage chance it's going to rain tomorrow, right? There's basically two ways of doing it. One would be take all the best physics of the world and, you know, look at pressure systems, you know, take a very theoretical approach and going, okay, well, this seems to be moving this way. This seems to be moving this way. This is what the physics of it tells us. The second way is what you could do is basically take all the data you have in the world and go, okay, what are the 100 days in history that look most like today? And go, okay, if it rained on 72 of those top 100 days, the chance of precipitation is 72%. That's essentially what we're doing here, but sort of blending those two models. And I know in meteorology, they found that a blended approach actually tends to work better than one or the other, that it kind of smooths out some of the things that the physics misses by having this sort of predictive approach. And then similarly, doing a rough, top 100 days approach can miss some of the underlying differences that the data may not be picking up on. So this is, a lot of this we could be sort of picking on economists, but this is fundamental in any kind of system that, as Scott points out, that where you can't go under the hood or you can't do controlled experiments, you either have to rely on the theory or, do some kind of big data type approach or try to find a way to blend the two.
Why is the Bank of Canada making this change right now?
Well, any forecasting model or policy model will degrade over time. And there's this cycle I see a lot in government and in central banks as well, where you have some really brilliant PhDs come in and build a state-of-the-art model. And then, of course, they don't want to do policy work. They want to be at their university publishing in journals and doing all of this other stuff. So they leave, and you have people like me who come in and just click the button and don't really know what they're doing. So they maintain the model over time. Well, they try to do their best to maintain it, and it slowly devolves and performs worse over time. And eventually you have to start from the bottom up and redo it.
When they're looking right now at how inflation kind of got out of control, I haven't heard in kind of mainstream media people talking about the Bank of Canada nearly as much as I have in the last couple of years. Is it because there's been that kind of that inflation that came up so high and they had to raise interest rates so quickly? Did that spur them to be like, okay, now's the moment. We need a new system. That's not working.
There certainly was a lot of things that came to light during the pandemic that showed kind of the gaps and the holes in our models. And so after the pandemic, they did realize, I don't think they could have done anything better. The inflation was so widespread around the world that the Bank of Canada, even if it had the perfect model that anticipated everything, I don't think they could have affected inflation in Canada. And I don't think that they would have taken a lot of guts to go against the narrative that, we'd had a 40-year trend of secular decline in inflation rates, and we'd been trying for years to generate even the middle of the Bank of Canada's target and failing. So it really did come as a surprise to people. But, some of the gaps, the financial sector is very poorly or bluntly modeled in these things. And we knew that after the global financial crisis. And that's one of the areas where they say it's going to be better represented now. The balance sheets of the economy, the assets that people own, the housing market was a big gap that they realized, and the inflation rate and the transmission mechanism to mortgages, to the housing, the asset prices, the house prices was poorly understood. And just all of those gaps certainly led to the motivation to revisit and fill in these gaps, which they do say this new DSGE model is going to have more nuance on. It's going to have less rationality. It's going to have more supply side analysis, and it's going to have just more realism, I suppose.
Mike. So at the end of the day, though, I wonder how much of this does matter. Like, I can't imagine Tiff Macklem, and I certainly can't imagine Mark Carney is, sitting at his desk. Somebody slaps a piece of paper on his desk and says, "Well, the computer says that you should raise 25 basis points." So, how much of these do actually inform? And we can, let aside, quantitative easing and tightening, just, the overnight rate target for the overnight rate decisions, how much of these are actually relied on?
That's the fun part. So none of this actually matters. It's, that's not true, but the forecast that you see in the monetary policy report is coming from the governing council. And there's a very good reason for that. They're the ones that are accountable to the Canadian public. And so you can't have these kind of staff projections behind the scenes going directly into the monetary policy report. So there is this level, and every bank governor has a different relationship with the research department. So you can start at James Elliott Coyne. James Elliott Coyne famously had no time for the research department. He did his own projections. He had his own metrics that he preferred to use. He called up his friends.
Wait, so you're saying basically they come up with all of this? They're like, this is what the best information we can give you. And then the people in charge go, my gut doesn't feel that.
So I think Stephen Poles was famously more of a gut-based guy. I don't want to speculate, but it's fun to speculate, so we will. Mark Carney, I think Mark Carney was more willing to take the briefing notes and have them translate directly into the report. I would suspect that TIFF is much the same. And there's a few adjustments they make, like they flatline the exchange rate, I think, just because if they put out
what
a forecast
mean?
Of the
flatline the exchange rate.
So if you had a fully consistent macro outlook where there are lots of moving parts, you'd expect like the exchange rate between Canada and the US to move around as well to be consistent with the kind of intellectual framework. But it's a convention that they just hold it steady at this, whatever it is now, basically over the outlook. And they have good reasons for that. I can't remember what they are, but I think that if they did put out a changing inflation rate, or rather a changing exchange rate, that markets would react and currency traders would essentially trade away that difference. So they just like to flatline it.
I just can't get over this, that they don't actually listen to the information. Like they're given all this information, so they spend so much time and money going into this, and then they don't use it. That's like surprising.
So that's a little too strong. They do. So the research department briefs this up. There's a Canadian economics division. There's an international economics division. They of course brief the governing council with all of the model results and everything, but you want those people in charge to be able to say, you know what, I don't like the look of that forecast. Let's fudge the number here. Let's put it in there, because they're the ones that are going to have to go to Parliament and answer questions, and they have to own it. They're the ones that ultimately could be, well, not fired, but would potentially be in a place where they would have to resign or would resign if they do very poorly. You want that process.
Yeah, I'll actually defend that the approach, because I think that, you know, the council should recognize the limitations of these models, so they can only tell you so many things. You know, I would, you know, based on the jerseys back here, I would think about this as, you know, like being a coach, right, where you get the scouting report, you know, on the opposing team or whatever, but and that will sort of inform, okay, you know, at this point, maybe pull the pitcher for this guy. But if you're watching the pitcher and he's doing well, and you know, the hitters are missing the curveball by about 2 feet, maybe you'll leave him in, you know, a little bit longer, even though the scouting report that you got, which was based on older information, you know, might suggest to do something different. So actually, you know, because I think, you know, you can get into these things of like, oh, well, they're disregarding this data. It's like, well, no, I mean, I think they're taking it into account, sort of recognizing the real time conditions that aren't forecasted into that. Because I think Scott's absolutely right that at the end of the day, it's the governor and the council who are accountable, not some, you know, not some computer running Excel or whatever in the background.
Scott, what do you think has a greater influence on what the central bank actually decides to do? Is it what the Federal Reserve in the U.S. does, or is it what our forecasting models tell us?
So we have this massive economy next to us called the United States, and we are going to really struggle to influence prices or inflation or anything compared to them. So historically, we tend to move with the Federal Reserve and mimic what they're doing to the south of us. There's been the odd time where we've led by a couple of weeks, but it is very difficult to see an alternative reality where Canada's monetary policy and the target rate goes in a different direction than the U.S.
Yeah, if our economies are doing differently, like if the U.S. is doing, if our, I think ours is doing better than the U.S. is right now. I can't remember. I just know that they're not in line right now. And if they're not in line, how do we then react that way? Like, if do we just have to do whatever they do? Do we actually have a say in the matter?
Yeah, well, I think that's a bit of a challenge, right? Just even saying who's doing better, who's doing worse, it really depends on which metric. Are you looking at unemployment, employment, inflation, GDP per capita, which is one that we spoke with recently with Armin. But, you know, there are times where, you know, we are going to be out of sync. I think the biggest example I can think of is the early 1990s, where, you know, our manufacturing sector got absolutely whacked in a way that, you know, the Americans not nearly as much. So, you know, largely, you know, we have to sort of recognize that the United States is our largest customer. So however they're doing economically is pretty much how we're doing economically. So we'll probably end up following them. But yeah, there can be these specific country-specific shocks that would lead us to go in one direction or another. And yeah, we see those from time to time. But mostly, you know, since our country's economic performance are so correlated with each other because we have such a large trading relationship, then yeah, we're probably going to move in the same direction. You know, we might be a couple of weeks first, they might be a couple of weeks first, but you know, at the end of the day, I would say, you know, 95 times out of 100, we're moving in the same direction at roughly the same speed.
I guess we'll have some time to figure out to watch it. It'll be interesting to see if we continue that trend right now, given where we are. But I think all this conversation has been really helpful to get more of an understanding of how this works. So thank you, Scott, so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. It's been great to have somebody talk to the Lucas critique about it. That's not something we usually get to do around here.
Thanks so much for watching and listening. And thanks, as always, to our producer, Meredith Martin.
And please like, subscribe, or leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you.
And we'll see you next time.